Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, August 8, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're experiencing a chance of morning showers with partly cloudy skies. Winds will be from the north at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Cedar Rapids will see a high of 79, 80 in Iowa City, and then falling to a low tonight of 58 in Cedar Rapids and 61 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 8:17 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow morning at 6:08 a.m. for a total daylight period of 14 hours and 10 minutes. And from today's front page, Coralville's 5th Street is getting a $5 million refresh. Work will be done in five phases over 2 years to limit traffic impacts. A story by Isabella Zaluska of the Gazette staff. A major part of Coralville's 5th Street, an area described as the city's civic center, will be getting an upgrade next year. The 5th Street reconstruction is one of the city's upcoming high-profile projects, said city engineer Scott Larson. Coralville Mayor Megan Foster said the street, which was first paved in 1921, is a vital and historic part of the community. It's also one of the city's busier pedestrian areas, Larson said. 5th Street is home to the Coralville Public Library, City Hall, S.T. Morrison Park, as well as a variety of businesses, apartment buildings, and other city buildings. It also hosts the city's 5th Street Social, which is coming up Saturday. 5th Street is the civic center of the community, with all of these community gathering spaces, the park, the library, the walkability, Foster said. It's really exciting to be thinking about how we want it to look for the next 100 years. The city is past the halfway point in the design phase and is hoping to bid the project in early 2023, Larson said. The current construction estimate is $5.5 million. Part of the project's cost will be covered by a $1.65 million surface transportation block grant that was awarded in 2019. The grant funds from the Metropolitan Planning Organization of Johnson County were programmed for fiscal 2023, which started in July. Larson said the city is working on a revised cost estimate now. That project design work is well underway. Work is planned to be done in phases, starting in the spring and continue over the next couple of years. Alongside this project, the city is thinking about how to enhance the public spaces adjacent to 5th Street. I love seeing how we can get creative about our public spaces and creating places in the community that are attractive for our residents to gather and to explore, Foster said. The portion of 5th Street to be reconstructed starts at 12th Avenue and goes through the 20th Avenue intersection. The 12th Avenue intersection will not be impacted. If you look out there today, we have a street, we have sidewalks, and we have a water main. We have all these things, but they're all original to the area. So it's really in need of a refresh or reconstruction to plan for the future and traffic volumes, Larson said. The total reconstruction includes tearing out the pavement and replacing the sidewalks, as well as new water main and storm sewer, Larson said. New trees, lighting, and landscaping also will be added. Overhead private utilities are being moved underground. This street will remain two lanes, but an 8-foot shared use path will be added along the north side of the street out to 20th Avenue, Larson said. It's really kind of rebuilding what's there, but trying to extend the 5th Street corridor aesthetic that we've built up on previous phases off to the east and extend that all the way west to 20th Avenue, Larson said. A focus of the project will be increasing the number and visibility of pedestrian crosswalks on 5th Street. The city is planning for five phases of construction spread over 2023 and 2024, Larson said. The goal is to be done with substantial traffic impacts by the end of 2024. Ideally, work in 2025 will be planting trees, landscaping, and other final touch-ups, he said. We have to maintain access to businesses and residences and do that in a reasonable way, according to Larson. The 2023 Fifth Street Social will not be impacted since it takes place east of 12th Avenue to 6th Avenue, Larson said. Larson said reconstructing this portion of Fifth Street has been on the city's list for many years. Most of the Fifth Street reconstruction in recent years has been east of 12th Avenue. This represents the last significant portion of Fifth Street that has not been reconstructed in the past 50 years, he said. Fifth Street from 10th Avenue to 12th Avenue was reconstructed from 1996 to 1999, and the portion from 5th Avenue to 9th Avenue was reconstructed from 2015 to 2016. When this project is finished, the 5th Street transformation will be nearly complete. Work still needs to be done at the intersection of 10th Avenue, where a roundabout is planned, and a short block north to 9th Avenue hasn't yet been reconstructed yet, Larson said. Along with the reconstruction, the city is exploring how civic spaces along the street, including those in front of city-owned buildings, could be enhanced, Larson said. The reconstruction isn't building any of those civic spaces. They would be future projects. But the city has conceptual boards displayed in city buildings to get residents thinking about the possibilities. A consultant has been hired, and the city has been hosting design meetings. We wanted to make sure that we had some ideas of what these spaces could be eventually so that we could make adjustments to the street project. And from today's Iowa Today section, a woman was seriously injured in a shooting outside the H Bar in Iowa City. Officers found her in an alley with multiple gunshot wounds. A story by John McLaughlin of the Gazette staff. A woman was seriously injured by multiple gunshots in an alley outside an Iowa City bar early Sunday, according to Iowa City Police Department news release. At 2:24 a.m., police responded to the H Bar at 2020 South Van Buren Street for a report of multiple shots fired and found the woman in an adjacent alley with multiple gunshot wounds. Investigating officers determined multiple people were in the alley when the shots were fired, the release stated. The woman was treated on the scene by emergency medical responders and transported to a hospital for serious injuries. A Hawk alert went out within minutes of the incident to advise the University of Iowa community to avoid the area and inform them that the shooter was still at large. A follow-up message said the incident appeared to be isolated. Iowa City Police said the suspected shooter was last seen fleeing the area in a vehicle, but intentionally offered no additional information about the incident, shooter, vehicle description, victim's identity or condition. The Iowa City Police Department is asking the public for assistance by sharing any related information or security camera footage. Information can be communicated directly with the police department by calling 319-356-5275. Also, Iowa City Area Crime Stoppers is offering a reward of up to $1,000 for information that leads to an arrest in the incident. Crime Stoppers tips can be submitted via the P3 Tips app online at iccrimestoppers.org or by phone at 319-358-TIPS. That's 8477. People providing information are not required to reveal their identity to collect a reward, according to the release. Also from the Iowa Today section, storms strand a family camping on the Wapsipinicon River sandbar. Crews rescue 5 people and 3 dogs near Quasqueton. Crews rescued 5 people and 3 dogs early Sunday from a sandbar in the Wapsipinicon River after overnight storms broke loose their kayaks and tubes, leaving them stranded. The Buchanan County Sheriff's Office received a 911 call about 7:45 a.m. from a man saying he and his family were camping on a sandbar on the river north of Quasqueton. Their tents collapsed in the overnight storms, but even more important, the bad weather sent their kayaks floating downstream. Firefighters launched a rescue boat from the Iron Bridge access and found the family upriver. The family and their dogs were brought ashore and no one was injured, the Buchanan County Sheriff's Office said. The Sheriff's Office was assisted in the rescue operation by the Quasqueton and Independence Fire Departments. Turning to today's insight or opinion page, we have a guest column by John Hendrickson, who's the Policy Director for Iowans for Tax Relief Foundation. And his article is entitled Herbert Hoover, America's Forgotten Conservative. President Herbert Hoover, born on August 10, 1874, led a remarkable life based upon public service, humanitarianism, and a belief that America is an exceptional nation. Nevertheless, many conservatives today are often critical of Hoover. Some have even described President Joe Biden as the next Herbert Hoover because of the current state of the economy. President Hoover's policies during the Great Depression can be debated, and they deserve more consideration, more than just the standard knee-jerk reaction often provided by many conservative and libertarian commentators. Nevertheless, Hoover deserves better. Herbert Hoover is a forgotten conservative statesman whose philosophy and ideas can still serve as a guide for conservatives. In reflecting on Hoover's conservatism, Richard Norton Smith, a Hoover biographer and presidential historian, wrote that none has more relevance to our own time than Hoover's role as a philosopher of modern conservative thought. Hoover's conservatism is often overshadowed because he's seen as a progressive, especially in comparison to his predecessors, Presidents Warren G. Harding and Calvin Coolidge. Hoover served as Secretary of the Commerce in both the Harding and Coolidge administrations, and he was viewed as an activist, especially in comparison to other cabinet officials, especially Secretary of the Treasury Andrew Mellon. Gordon Lloyd and David Davenport, who co-authored The New Deal and Modern American Conservatism, A Defining Rivalry, argue that Hoover's philosophy was to balance progressivism while still defending the Constitution. From a philosophical standpoint, Hoover rejected laissez-faire, and he outlined his political philosophy in his 1921 book, American Individualism. In American Individualism, Hoover defended what he described as the American system and the principle of equality and of opportunity. Lloyd and Davenport wrote that Hoover's American system was centered on individual freedom and equality of opportunity, which leads to a sense of responsibility, which inspires Americans to take care of each other while pursuing their own and their community's best interests, unhindered by government bureaucracy or central planning. This was the philosophy that governed Hoover's humanitarianism, and when President Coolidge tasked him with the responsibility of organizing relief efforts for the 1927 Mississippi River flood, I suppose I could have called in the whole of the army. But what was the use? All I had to do was to call in Main Street itself, stated Hoover, in response to the call of Americans that helped provide relief to those who were suffering because of the flood. This is also the spirit that many Iowans took during the COVID-19 pandemic as neighbors and businesses helped one another in numerous acts of goodwill across the state. In the 1929 presidential campaign, Hoover won in a landslide, and his philosophy of the American system would guide his administration. The onset of the Great Depression would not just be a turning point for Hoover, but for the nation. During the 1932 presidential campaign, Hoover would defend his administration, but because of the severity of the Depression, he was defeated in a landslide by New York Governor Franklin D. Roosevelt, who during the campaign promised the nation a New Deal. At the close of the 1932 campaign, Hoover stated, "This campaign is more than a contest between two men. It is more than a contest between two parties. It is a contest between two philosophies of government." Hoover was prophetic, as Roosevelt's New Deal would radically transform not only the federal government, but constitutionalism. Lloyd and Davenport argue that we can now see more clearly that the New Deal was America's French Revolution, and the post-presidential Herbert Hoover, if not our Edmund Burke, was at least a prophetic voice crying in the progressive wilderness of the 1930s, pointing the way toward what has become modern American conservatism. Hoover would become the leading conservative voice against the New Deal and its centralization of federal power and thwarting the Constitution. In 1934, he wrote, "The Challenge to Liberty, which was a philosophical defense of both the Constitution and the American system," and he warned about the ideologies, including New Deal liberalism, which were attacking constitutionalism. As a result of the New Deal, Lloyd and Davenport wrote that Hoover became a full-throated constitutional conservative, horrified by what he called the challenge to liberty from Roosevelt's New Deal. Hoover's opposition to New Deal liberalism would influence future conservatives, including Senators Robert A. Taft and Barry Goldwater. Hoover also supported numerous conservative causes and organizations. As an example, he was an early supporter of William F. Buckley's National Review magazine. Most important was his creating and funding of the Hoover Institution of War, Revolution, and Peace at Stanford University, a project begun during World War I. Today, the Hoover Institution is a prominent public policy think tank and archive. Conservatives, especially national conservatives, who wish to see a restoration of limited government and foreign policy based upon the national interest, should consider Hoover's response to the New Deal liberalism. He attempted to remind Americans about the Constitution, federalism, and the importance of a limited government. Hoover's campaign against the New Deal was an example of conservative statesmanship, which can serve as a guide for today's conservative movement. And that piece by John Hendrickson, a policy director of Iowans for Tax Relief Foundation. Turning to today's letters to the editor, we have two of them today. The first one coming from Dave LaRonde of Cedar Rapids. His letter is entitled, "Coal is Wrong to Blame President Biden for Oil Prices." I may not always agree with Insight columnist Althea Cole's opinions, but they're almost always well-reasoned. But in her July 31 column about the Biden administration's oil policies, generalization led to bad conclusions. If gas prices were the only items on President Joe Biden's plate, she's right. However, she missed the gorilla and the elephant in the room. The gorilla, a COVID pandemic, with shutdowns, lockdowns, and widespread COVID misinformation throwing the industry into chaos. First, we didn't need much oil, but now we demand far more as the disease loosens its grip. Basic economics gave us dirt cheap oil 2 years ago, and now we pay far more because supply can't keep up. This isn't just limited to America. It's happening worldwide. And the elephant? is climate change. Just in the past weeks, water supplies in the Southwest are at a critical record low, and there are record high temperatures in the Pacific Northwest and the UK, and devastating wildfires in France. We've been told over and over that humankind's fossil fuel addiction is the culprit. World leaders pledged to cut fossil fuel use. Biden is among them, as well he should be. It's easy to say drill, baby, drill, but it could lead to bake, baby, bake. So he walks an oil policy tightrope. Can we escape by turning the clock back 50 years? No. We now have to pay the piper for past misdeeds and excesses. We have to face today's reality. The Biden administration is doing just that. And that letter by Dave LaRonde of Cedar Rapids. The next letter comes from Gary Sanders of Iowa City. It's entitled, Amid Record Prices, Oil Companies Have Record Profits. Like most people, I've been worrying about the price of gasoline. Even my economical little 2016 Ford Focus eats up about $41 when I fill the tank. I know that there are a lot of causes for high gasoline prices, but I've been wondering how the oil companies have been doing. I got my answer to that question on the front page of the July 30 Wall Street Journal. Soaring fuel prices catapult oil giants to record profits. As reported in the Wall Street Journal, here are the oil giants' profits for just the second quarter of 2022. Exxon, the largest U.S. oil company, reported profits of $17.9 billion, its highest ever. Shell reported its second consecutive record profit at $16.7 billion, and Chevron also posted a record profit at $11.6 billion. You might want to chew on those numbers the next time you fill up your gas tank. This by Gary Sanders of Iowa City. We also have a guest column today by Norman Sherman. Mr. Sherman is from Coralville and has worked extensively in politics, including as Vice President Hubert Humphrey's press secretary, and has authored a memoir entitled From Nowhere to Somewhere. His article or guest column is entitled The Danger of Delusions Threatening Our Democracy. I recently received a fan letter. Here was the question, are you a pedophile like your hero Joe Biden? His next letter will inevitably be vulgar and paranoid, but at least he's reading the Gazette. I share the letter here as a public service. Everyone should know who is living among us, maybe attending the same church and voting. Norman, I read your pieces in the CR Gazette. You really love the Democrats. To you, they can do no wrong. The truth is that the Democratic Party hates children. If Democrats can't convince a woman to kill the baby in a womb, the next step is convincing women to spay or neuter children or block their puberty. If that doesn't work, the Democrats encourage children to be sex freaks. If that doesn't work, Democrats are hell-bent on shaming anyone trying to get married and have children in what used to be called a normal family. Are you a pedophile like your idol, Joe Biden? Do you like to groom and expletive children? I bet you do, you expletive pervert. If my correspondent were a single voice of political paranoia, it wouldn't make much difference to the rest of us. I'd file the letter in the wastebasket. But he's not alone, nor even rare. He's one of the millions of Americans who can deny reality with ease and see things that aren't there. They are a clear and present danger. I don't know what else my buddy believes, but delusion comes in packages. On a fishing trip to Minnesota recently, I met a guy who believed there was widespread voting fraud, citing Donald Trump. He believes that Senator Paul Wellstone's plane crash death in 2002 was not an accident, but caused by the federal government, that the Holocaust didn't happen, and that no planes were found after 9/11. My letter writer and my new friend might be ignored if they only represented a small number of Americans. A recent poll found that 56% of Americans of voting age had little or no confidence that elections represent the will of the people. Our democracy has survived the delusional and paranoid before. Senator Joe McCarthy in the 1950s found communists hiding under every desk in the State Department. Robert Welch, who made gumdrops for a living, founded the John Birch Society. He claimed that Dwight Eisenhower was under the influence of his closet communist brother, Milton. In the 19th century, Roman Catholics were the target. Pregnant nuns were murdering their newborns so they would go quickly to heaven. Later, the Masonic Lodge replaced the Pope. Masons were secretly manipulating government. Later, General George Marshall, a hero of World War II, serving as Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense under Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, was accused of being a communist. We have survived all of that, but today, delusions more threatening than nuns having babies, Masonic secret activities, or communists in the shadows. Delusion is not good for democracy. That piece by Norman Sherman of Coralville. And you're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, August 8, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First, from Cedar Rapids, James O. Harnagle, age 82, died on Friday, August 5. A private family services will be held. The Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. And from Marion, Valene Peterson, a celebration of life is at 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday, August 13, at Trinity Point Apartments Community Room. From Cedar Rapids, Janet Joy Kern Wagner spent her life advocating for the less fortunate, the poor, and especially the mentally handicapped. A celebration of her life will be held in September. And from Cedar Rapids, Nick Margolos, age 93, died on Saturday, August 6. Visitation is from 5 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, August 10, at the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids, with the Trisagion service beginning at 7 p.m. Funeral service at 10 a.m. on Thursday, August 11, at St. John the Baptist Greek Orthodox Church in Cedar Rapids. A burial is in Linwood Cemetery, also in Cedar Rapids. And from Cedar Rapids, David John Dempsey, age 74, passed away on Friday, July 22. There will be a celebration of life announced at a later time. From Mount Vernon, Carol M. Covington, age 87, passed away on Friday, August 5. Funeral services are at 11:30 a.m. Tuesday, August 9, at the Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon by celebrant Dawn Stevens. A visitation will begin at 10 a.m. Burial in Mount Vernon Memorial Cemetery. From North Liberty, Kenneth, also known as Ken Shawl, age 71, passed away suddenly but naturally on August 4 from a cardiac event. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, August 9, with a funeral service held at 10 a.m. Wednesday, August 10, both at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service at 605 Kirkwood Avenue in Iowa City. A private family committal service will be held at Ridgewood Cemetery. From Moorhead, Minnesota, Andrea Stolba Ritzky, age 58, passed away on Thursday, August 5, at her family's home in Minot, North Dakota. A celebration of life will be held at 10 a.m. Tuesday, August 9, at the Thompson Larson Funeral Home in Minot. The service will be live-streamed for the public to view and can be accessed on the internet. The interment will follow the service at the Rose Hill Memorial Park in Minot. From Bernard, Ryan J. Kramer, age 29, passed away at his home surrounded by his loving family from complications of Friedrich's ataxia on Saturday, August 6. Private visitation and family services will be held on Tuesday, August 9, at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade. Burial will be held at St. Patrick's Cemetery in Epworth. Services will be live streamed on the St. Thomas Aquinas Pastorate Facebook page for those who wish to view it. From North Liberty, Farron L. Baxter, age 65, died on Friday, August 5, at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Memorial services will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday, August 13, at the Gay and Shia Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City, where there will be a time of visitation 1 hour prior to the services and a time of fellowship to follow the services. From Iowa City, Catherine, also known as Kathy Elizabeth Irwin Penningroth, died on May 27, attended by her family, and she died of heart failure at the Birdhouse Hospice Home of Johnson County. There will be a service celebrating Kathy's life from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Sunday, August 14, at the Kirkwood Room in Iowa City. Family and friends are welcome to share short stories and memories of Kathy between noon and 1 p.m. Memorial donations may be made to the League of Women Voters of Johnson County. From Iowa City, Joseph D. Brisbane passed away on January 27. A celebration of Joe's life will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, August 13, at the Unitarian Universalist Society at 2355 Oakdale Road in Coralville. A celebration will be live streamed on the Unitarian Universalist Society YouTube channel. Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City is handling the arrangements. And in other death notices today, from Andrew, George Roeder, age 90, died on Friday, August 5. The Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa is attending the family. From Cedar Rapids, Robert G. Bumstead, age 97, died Saturday, August 6. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. And from Clarence, Robert King Kelly, age 88, died on Saturday, August 6. The Chapman Funeral Home in Clarence is assisting the family. From Fort Atkinson, Ida Ameling, age 95, died on Saturday, August 6. The Helms Funeral Home, Checkle Chapel in Fort Atkinson is assisting the family. From Independence, Mary Ann Shans, age 91, died on Thursday, August 4. The White Funeral Home in Independence is assisting the family. From Kelowna, Delilah Edith Anderson, age 94, died Friday, August 5. The Beatty Petersheim Funeral Home in Kelowna is assisting the family. From Lost Nation, Jody A. Foyce, age 68, died Saturday, August 6. The Dawson Funeral and Services in Maquoketa is assisting the family. From Olawine, Ardith E. Groff, age 95, died Saturday, August 6. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olawine is assisting the family. Also from Olawine, Jack L. Hemmingson, age 81, died Friday, August 5. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olawine is assisting the family. And from Olawine, Deborah Clendworth, age 58, died Friday, August 5. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olawine is assisting the family. Finally, also from Olawine, Deanna R. Lopez, age 49, died Friday, August 5. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olawine is assisting the family. Turning to today's sports page, we have a story about amateur golf entitled James, Give Me Five. Golf coach becomes the first five-time winner of the City Am by Cully Klein of the Gazette staff. The Cedar Rapids Men's City Amateur Golf Tournament has its first time, five-time champion. Linmar Head Boys and Girls Golf Coach Chris James endured the rain, a late rally, and a playoff to come out on top in dramatic fashion yet again. Winning five wasn't in my mind, James said. Once you get two or three, you start thinking, all right, it feels great. James entered the weekend tied with Sam Aosi and Bob Coldsmith at four titles. James had previously won the event in 2008, 2010, 2014, and 2018. Heavy rains delayed the start of the third round at Ellis Golf Course by about a half an hour. James and Dustin Atkinson entered the day tied at 8-under. 18 holes did not separate them. Atkinson, a former UNI golfer, competing in the tournament for the first time, entered 17 two strokes back. He made a 20-foot putt on 17 for a birdie. Then he birdied 18 after going in the bunker to force a playoff. I told myself if I just go par-par on 17 and 18, I gotta make him make birdies, James said. Doing that on 17 and 18 is not an easy task out here. I wasn't really down on myself. I wasn't like I made bogey. I knew Atkinson had a little momentum going. It was kind of nice. We did a draw and I was able to tee off first. Going back to the first hole to begin the playoff, James and Atkinson were still square as they moved to number nine. James found himself closer to the pin for a par. When Atkinson's putt came up a little short, James analyzed his options from 8 to 10 feet away. I felt like I knew the line pretty well, James said. It was a right to lefter downhill, so I didn't feel like I had to slam it. The greens were a little bit slower than Ellis typically is. I think the rain probably had something to do with that. I was able to let it die near the hole, and James sunk the putt and let out a roar. Exhausting, James said. I didn't think I had it this morning. I wasn't playing particularly well the first nine holes. I was just kind of off a little bit. I saw a putt go in on 13, saved a par. It was just a mentally exhausting day. You have to be on for every shot, 4, 5 to 6 hours. For Atkinson, it was a successful debut in the tournament. It was a lot of fun, Atkinson said. Me and Chris went back and forth the last couple of days, trading birdies. He's a great putter and a great player. I was just glad to make birdie on the last two to give him a run. I felt good, ready to go. Just didn't quite roll the rock good enough on the last two shots. I gave my last one a run. Just came up a little short. Both entered the playoff after finishing the 54-hole event at 9-under par. James wasn't the only five-time winner on the day. Todd Hinkgen took home his fifth senior City Am trophy with a 3-over par performance for the weekend. It was Hinkgen's second consecutive win in the event. And here's your Dear Abby for today. It's entitled, Father Lies to Keep Kids in Line. Dear Abby, my parents are divorced. My father, who I'm sure loves me in his own way, is controlling and manipulative. He wasn't nice to my older siblings either. He constantly lied and blamed others for his abusive behavior, which made me hate them. He claimed Mom cheated on him and said my siblings were horrible kids. As I grew older, I started seeing through his lies. He also uses his approval as a weapon to make me feel guilty and do what he wants. For example, he's very religious, and he told me that if I wasn't religious, he'd stop loving me. I just want to live my life, but I know if I do, he'll cut me off and keep my younger siblings from communicating with me. He wants me to marry someone from our religion, but I have fallen in love with someone who doesn't have our same points of view. This person is aware of the situation, but eventually, if things progress, my dad will find out. What should I do? Signed, Lost Girl in Vermont. And Abby responds, if you live under your father's roof, you will have to abide by his house rules for now. When you become independent, you can then consider which religion meets your needs and whom you want to marry. I assume you already have a strong relationship with your younger siblings. Keep working on it, and your father will have a harder time making them think ill of you in the future. Turning to today's community page, an article entitled Hibrai, that's H-I-B-R-A-I, returns for the 19th year with Eastern Iowa Bike Ride. Hiawatha Parks and Rec-led ride goes from Hiawatha to Riverside and back. A story by Gage Miskimmon of the Gazette staff. While Ragbri has come and gone, bicycle enthusiasts looking for another ride don't have to look farther than Hiawatha. The 19th Hibrai, stands for Hiawatha Bike Ride Around Iowa, takes place the weekend of August 20 and 21. Riders will start at Hiawatha City Hall and follow mostly trails all the way down to Riverside. It's an intermediate ride, Hiawatha Parks and Recreation Director Kelly Willadson said. Both days equal 110 miles. So it's a bit of a challenge, but there's no speed that has to be taken. It's a fun ride for people to have a fun weekend out and about. If you haven't done a huge ride, this is a great one to start with. The charity ride benefits the Friends of Hiawatha Parks and Recreation, a nonprofit organization that supports local children's programs and park updates. Willardson said the ride typically raises around $8,000 to $10,000 per year. The funds raised have gone to new drinking fountains, park amenities. Last year, we purchased our outdoor movie system. We've purchased playground equipment before, she said. It allows the dollars to stay in the Hiawatha community and in the parks and rec atmosphere. Day one of the ride ends with an overnight stay at the Riverside Casino and Golf Resort, where riders receive a special rate of $129.95 for a king or double, usually priced at $249.95. The registration fee for the ride is $60, and registration can be found online at the Friends of Hiawatha Parks and Recreation website. The event began when members of the Hiawatha Parks and Rec Department took its Ragbri proposal to Des Moines by bike. That was the first ride, Willenson said. Over the years, it's been to Des Moines, Tama, and Riverside. But in recent years, the route has stayed the same due to the route being around 90% trail. After each event, we send out a survey, and people really enjoy going down to Riverside, Willardson said. It's super great for the safety of our riders. We don't have to worry about cars. On average, the ride sees about 120 participants each year. So far, between 50 and 60 people have signed up. So Willardson said there's room for more to participate and book hotel rooms. Right now, it's a bit slower, and last year was too, coming back from COVID, she said. It's an enjoyable, relaxing ride. It allows riders to have more fun and not be a congested ride. Plus, people don't have to stay either. They can ride a day and set up their own pickup and drop off from there if they would like. And we have several things to do today. The first one is a kid-friendly activity, the Mobile Technology Lab. The library is partnering with Cedar Rapids Parks and Recreation's Roland Recmobile to bring activities for all ages to the community this summer. It's from 9:30 to 11:30 at the Redmond Park, 16th Street Southeast and 3rd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids, and from 1:30 to 3:30 p.m. at Jacqueline Park at 198 Jacqueline Drive Northwest in Cedar Rapids. The cost is free. And they have we have a film entitled Summer Kids Dream Family Film Series. You can watch the Angry Birds Movie 2 this week. It's from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at the Marcus Cedar Rapids Cinema at 5340 Council Street Northeast in Cedar Rapids. The cost is $3. And a community activity from the Oak Hill Jackson Neighborhood Association. Learn what's happening in the neighborhood, including events, crime, and nuisance reports. The special speaker is Horizons, from 6 to 7:30 p.m. today at Horizons at 819 5th Street, Southeast in Cedar Rapids. The cost is free. An outdoor activity entitled Afternoon Nature and Forest Therapy Experience. Join certified nature and forest therapy guide Amelia Sauter for a walk with the natural world. It's from 2:30 to 3:45 p.m. at the Prairie Woods Franciscan Spirituality Center at 120 East Boyson Road in Hiawatha. The cost is $15. And a community activity entitled Music with Friends. Join volunteer minstrel Richard Hansen in singing familiar tunes with others who enjoy music. It's open to caregivers and care receivers. It's from 10 to 10:45 a.m. today, and it's online with Family Caregivers Center of Mercy. Cost is free. And a museum exhibit entitled Righting a Wrong, Japanese Americans and World War II. This traveling exhibition from the Smithsonian examines the complicated history and impact of Executive Order 9066 that led to the incarceration of 75,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry and 45,000 Japanese nationals following the attack on Pearl Harbor. It's from 9:30 to 4 p.m. today at the National Czech and Slovak Museum and Library at 1400 Inspiration Place Southwest in Cedar Rapids. And the cost varies from free to $10. And we have several Eastern Iowa briefs today. The first is a Johnson County Master Gardeners will offer a flower fundraiser on Sunday. Johnson County Master Gardeners will offer cut flowers for sale from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Sunday at the Johnson County Fairgrounds at 3109 Old Highway 218 South in Iowa City. Last year's flowers were such a hit that Master Gardeners duplicated the zinnia garden and added a variety of sunflowers. The drive-up fundraiser allows supporters to buy bouquets without leaving their vehicles. Cash and checks will be accepted. Credit card purchase is not available. The suggested cost of a single bouquet is $5 or $9 for two. Specialty bouquets will not be available this year. The proceeds from the flower fundraiser support the demonstration garden, the JCMG programs and operations, 4-H awards, and Kirkwood Community College horticulture scholarships. And from Ely, the Cedar Amateur Astronomers to hold a family event on Sunday. Bring the kids and join Cedar Amateur Astronomers to see more James Webb Space Telescope images at 1 p.m. Sunday at the Eastern Iowa Observatory and Learning Center at 1365 Ivanhoe Road in Ely. The center is in the Palisade Dows Preserve, 6 miles southeast of Cedar Rapids off Highway 30. There will be many activities indoors and outside, weather permitting. NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory Solar System Ambassador Mark Brown will discuss Webb's first images from July and any new ones released. Brown will talk about some of the science learned from these images and take questions. There also will be a live expert panel discussion straight from NASA, exclusive to host sites only, and guests are welcome to submit questions in advance or during the live chat. Families can visit new web-related displays and check out equipment, including a 16-inch computer-controlled telescope and a 24-inch Bowler and Chivins Cassegrain professional-grade telescope. From Keosauqua, bike the villages of Van Buren County, August 20 and 21. The villages of Van Buren County will host the 36th annual Bike Van Buren on August 20 and 21. Bicycling enthusiasts will pedal their way through the rolling countryside and river valley of the historical villages during this two-day event in southeast Iowa. Register for Bike Van Buren online at villagesofvanburen.com through August 17. Walk-up registration is welcome and will be held from 7 to 8:30 a.m. August 20 at the Keosauqua City Park. Walk-up registration also will be at the Keosauqua City Park on Sunday from 7:30 to 8 a.m. August 21 for riders who only plan to go that day. Two-day registration fees are adults for $45, children under 18 years at $37, single-day registration for adults is $35, and children at $27. Riders will have the option to buy a lunch at registration. That's $13 for adults and $9 for youth. Routes for both Saturday and Sunday have a primary route along with alternate routes. Riders are always welcome to create their own route. All routes will begin and end at the Keosauqua City Park at Park Street and Main Street. And from Dubuque, Chris Norton to deliver a fall lecture on October 10. Chris Norton, a former football defensive back at Luther College, who faced a life-altering injury, will deliver the fall 2022 Michael Lester Wendt Character Lecture at 7 p.m., October 10, in John and Alice Butler Hall at the Heritage Center at the University of Dubuque. The lecture is free and no tickets are required. On August 16, 2010, at the age of 18, Norton suffered a debilitating spinal cord injury. While playing football at Luther, he was given a 3% chance of ever moving again below the neck. Despite the prognosis, Norton persevered and recovered enough sensation and mobility to walk across the stage at his college graduation and down the aisle for his wedding. Norton and his wife, Emily Norton, are adoptive and foster parents and authors of the book, The Seven Longest Yards. Norton also was the subject of a 2021 documentary, 7 Yards, The Chris Norton Story. His nonprofit foundation, Chris Norton Foundation, raises funds to improve the quality of life for those with disabilities and runs an adaptive wheelchair camp every summer that's free of charge. Titled The Power to Stand, the lecture is presented by UD's Wendt Character Initiative as part of its mission to promote a campus culture of excellent moral character and personal lives. And our pet of the week is Muffin. Muffin is a 3-year-old female buff short-haired cat available for adoption through the Cedar Rapids Animal Care and Control. She enjoys cuddling and is okay around dogs and cats. but would prefer a home with no kids. Call 319-286-5993 for more information. And from the Iowa Today section, an article entitled Decorah Man Writes Definitive Book on the Villisca Axe Murders, a story by Melody Parker of the Gazette staff. Ed Epperly is considered an authority on the worst mass murder in Iowa history. The retired Luther College professor has spent more than six decades delving into the 1912 horrific murders of a prominent Villisca family and two overnight guests. Epperly's recently published true crime nonfiction book, Fiend Incarnate, Villisca, Iowa Axe Murders of 1912, is the result of his comprehensive research. This is an iconic case and stands right up there with Jack the Ripper and Lizzie Borden. These murders haven't just gotten that kind of publicity, and the community of Villisca tried to repress news about it when it happened, Epperly said. The tragedy remains unsolved. On June 10, 1912, the small community of Villisca awoke to the violent murders of Josiah and Sarah Moore and their four children, Herman, Catherine, Boyd, and Paul, and guests Lena and Ina Stillinger. They were discovered brutally bludgeoned to death in their beds. I heard about the murders as a child in the 1940s, when my dad and his brothers would get together and sometimes talk about it, recalled Epperly, a native of southern Iowa. There weren't enough hearses in Villisca to carry the eight victims to their resting place, so horses and wagons carried several small coffins. A mass grave was opened in the small cemetery to receive the Moore family, and the Stillinger children were buried nearby. As an undergraduate and graduate history major at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, Epperly shared the Villisca story with his classmates. In 1956, he and two friends decided to do some original research for a class, and the three of us went to Villisca and spent a long weekend there, interviewing a number of people and seeing the sights. The house where the murders took place was privately owned, so we weren't able to go inside. Today, it's the Paranormal Hotel. After graduation, Epperly shoved the research into a drawer and got on with his teaching career. In the 1970s, the professor renewed his interest in the case. I wanted to save the history, and I was able to do that and provide access to the story. This has been a lifetime of work. Now I can sit back and smile and feel good about it, he added. The book is available at independent bookstores and in print and ebook form at Amazon.com.